are familiar with various stresses in our lives. We have the stress of raising children, the stress of marrying children off. And those of you who have little children, when your parents said to you, little children, little problems, big children, big problems, you can believe it. And Baruch Hashem, all within the realm of the normal, but when you have to go from raising them to marrying them off, and your heart is in your shoes, and it's a stress. Then there are the other things, the day-to-day kind of stress, of juggling schedules. I was talking to some lovely women here yesterday, and they told me about how difficult it is for them to manage going to work, raising their children, trying to be involved in community, and it does give rise to stress. Many of the women yesterday told me that the greatest stress in their life is not having enough hours in the day. When you have to choose, you have only so many hours, and your mother needs you, and your mother-in-law needs you, and your children need you. Now, wherever you are, you're in one place, you're not in someplace else. We know that we have, I know all of us have experienced, and I talk from personal experience, that wherever I am, I'm in a sense feeling guilty that I'm not somewhere else, because there are so many demands on our life. Then the whole situation of the aging process. And it's not so much what we observe in ourselves, because we never age. You know, we're still waiting to find out what we're going to be when we grow up. But everybody around us, we give a look at the parents who used to be in full bloom, and now we give a look at how incapacitated they are and how limited they are. We look at, we had an experience, our community went to visit with in the old age home. We took our youngsters along. Older people love nothing more than seeing young children. And we went from person to person there, and these were the movers and the shakers of the community just yesterday. And here they are sitting in wheelchairs and so forth. And it's a sobering kind of thought, and it does, you know, give you a chachke, like they say in Yiddish. If you don't know what it means, it's just what it sounds like. And it gives rise to certain stressful thoughts. And of course, then there are, God forbid, the illnesses and the pain that we see around us. Pain and suffering, and of course that gives rise to stresses. Now, I think that basically we have to establish right at the outset that life is stressful. Just living, life is stressful, and that's the way it was meant to be. And that's not a negative statement. And as our sources tell us, it's only lamesim chavshi. It's only people who are dead, who are basically free, home free, without any stress. And certainly none of us want to find ourselves in that place. So long as we live and we breathe, there is stress. And stress is necessary in order for us to produce. Stress, there are constructive aspects to stress. And now that's really what we want to discuss here tonight, is how to keep stress manageable and how to make it constructive, how to mitigate against the negative aspects of stress that affect adversely our body, our spirit, our psyche, and how do we create a healthy context within which stress can do what it needs to do, but not the adverse effects. So let's begin first by, and you have to hang in here a little bit because this is the heavier part of it, and then we'll get to some practical things. But first and foremost, if we want to be able to handle stress and stressful situations in life, what we need to do, I think it's Viktor Frankl who had said that if we have a why to live for, then we can contend with almost any how. If we have a why to live for, we have to know why it is that we live, why it is that we exist. And once we understand why, what it is that we live for, then whatever life dishes out, then we can handle it. If, obviously, if we don't understand why, then life becomes absurd. And we know that for some people it is absurd. When life gets too painful, then they jump off the roof, they take drugs and so forth and so on, because it's meaningless. They have no context for it. And I want to share with you a little vart that I heard actually at my daughter's vart. You know what a vart is? A vart is in lieu of an engagement. With engagement is called a tanoim. A tanoim is when a written document is drawn up as a part of an engagement. And in lieu of a written document, what the process is called, when everybody gets together and you bring out the schnapps and you drink a l'chaim and you wish each other mazel tov, it's called a vart. A vart in Yiddish means a word. which means that we give each other a word that now we have committed ourselves to each other, both parties, and it's in lieu of this written document. So my brother got up to speak at my daughter's vart, and he asked the question of why is a vart called a vart? Why is it called a word above and beyond what we've just mentioned? And he said that there's a very interesting Talmudic statement. Talmudic statement says that all of life, Hai Alma Kibaya Hilula Dimya, that life is likened to a wedding. And everybody goes on to kind of speculate, what does the Talmud mean that life is compared to a wedding? And they say that at a wedding what happens is that you go through, and we know we saw a little bit of a wedding type affair last night. We just didn't have a chasen last night. We didn't have the groom. But otherwise, it was, you had the caterer, and you had the flowers, and you had the hall, and you have all the various arrangements, all the parts that make for a successful wedding. And you can have that all in place, and the bride and groom are under the chuppah, and the groom says to the bride, Hare at mikudeshes b'taba'azu kedas Moshe v'Yisrael. What's missing? Li. There's one word, a vart, one word that's missing, li. And everything else that's happened is for naught. No, there's nothing binding in this. Nothing has happened. A marriage has not taken place because there's one word, the word li, is missing. What he has to say is, behold, thou art consecrated li unto me with this ring. And if he misses the word, if he doesn't say the word li, then everything else was to no avail. It accomplished absolutely nothing. The vart. In the Jewish sources, li is referred to as li lishmi. The Almighty refers to the word li, meaning for my sake, the Almighty says, and for my name, on my behalf. Meaning that this entire world, the way we're supposed to move through this world, is to have a God concept, a concept of that li, the li in big letters, the li of the Almighty, connecting ourselves, developing a relationship with God. That's why we were brought into this world, to have that relationship with the Almighty. And everything else is the caterer, and it's the flowers, and it's the hall, and it's and all those details. And all of them, if the li of the relationship with God is not in place, then everything else that we experience in life is for nothing. Then nothing has happened. If we come to the end, at the conclusion of 120 years, and the li in our life has not taken hold, that relationship has not been fostered, then no wedding has taken place. No life has taken place. Nothing has happened. There has to be the li lishmi. And this is elaborated a little bit, and I'm not going to go on. This is the last word here that yesterday at the Bas Mitzvah, we had many talks about the dreams that we had in last week's Sedrin. Remember the dreams that Paro had, the dreams of 7 fat years and 7 lean years. And it's interesting, one of the commentaries points out in the name of Rabbi Lapian, very wonderful thought. He says that Yosef says to Paro, after he gives him an interpretation of the dreams, the cows, it's 7 cows, 7 fat cows, lean cows, and he tells him what it means, that they're going to be 7 rich years, years of plenty, which are going to be followed by 7 years of poverty and of hunger. And he's telling him, make sure now that you get somebody in place to provide, to take from the years of plenty and to provide for the years of hunger. So the expression that Yosef uses when he talks to Paro is, Vato yira Paro ish novon v'chacham. Now Paro, see to it that the person that you appoint, that you give this job to, is a person who's wise and who has wisdom and who has understanding. And Rabbi Lapian asked the question. He says, why did he tell him that he needs somebody wise and somebody with understanding? If you want to figure out how to take 7 years where you have a lot and provide the 7 years when you have a little, then what you need is basically an accountant. You know, get yourself an accountant who can figure out the statistics here and the figures, and he'll be the manager over the whole thing in Fartik. What do you need a wise and understanding person? So he goes on to explain what Yosef was telling him is that it's very, very difficult at a time of plenty when we're not lacking for anything and it's just more and more and more to envision to envision and to imagine that there could be such a thing as a time of hunger. It takes somebody very wise, and the definition of a wise person, the Mishnah says, Ezahu chacham haroa es hanolad. Who is a wise person? Somebody who is able to see that which is yet to be born, that which is yet going to happen. That's the definition of a wise person. So he said, in this case, when we're now involved in a situation where there's plenty, and we're eating, and we're drinking, and there's affluence, and there's so much to be had, for somebody to oversee this, you need to have somebody who can envision what's down the pike, what's coming up. And he said that this is really the nature of life. That life, our world, Olam Hazeh, as it's referred to, are the years of plenty. They're the years of plenty, the world we find ourselves in, this world of illusion, this Olam HaSheker, if you will, is such that it's a world of plenty. How is it a world of plenty? Here in this world, we have opportunities that we will never again have. We have opportunities to do the kind of things, mitzvahs, masim tovim, the learning of Torah, that we can have. We have earning power in this world. What that means is that because we have a situation in this world where we have these two forces contending for our choice, the force of evil and the force of good, are contending for our choice. Every time that we choose good over evil, we've earned that which we will have both in this world and in the world to come. That earning power, the ability to earn, we don't have in the world to come. We believe in eternity, we believe in the world to come, but in that world, we will reap the benefits of what we've earned in this world. But because there will be no evil in that world, we will not have an opportunity to earn anything in that world. So it's only here that we have the ability to earn that which we will have, to earn that good that the Almighty wants to bestow upon us. So here, this year, we find ourselves in this world of plenty. They say that the Gaon of Vilna, when he was about to die, after living a wonderful life, he was a sage, he was a saint, however, he was the greatest. And when he was about to die, his students, his disciples, found him crying. And they said to him, Rebbe, you of all people should be crying as you're about to leave this world? You live the way we're all supposed to live. What are you afraid of? In the next world, you'll have it so good. So he said, don't you understand? He said, I'm crying because it's so easy to do a mitzvah. It's so easy to earn in this world. All you need to do is put a penny in a pushka. All you need to do is smile at somebody. All you need to do is interact in a decent way with people at work. All you need to do is give somebody a pat on the back. All you need to do is an act of observing Shabbos. All I need to do is to kiss my tzitzis, to make a bracha, to make a blessing. It's so easy. Earning power in this world is so easy. I'm so reluctant to leave this world of plenty where it's so easy to earn every step along the way, from the minute we wake up in the morning to the moment we go to sleep at night. There are tons, millions of opportunities to earn. He said, I hate to leave a world where there is so much plenty. In contrast to that, the world to come is that world, that lean time, because there we will only reap the benefits of that which we've earned in this world, but we don't have that earning power any longer. So he says that the way we can understand it is a wonderful kind of sobering parable. He said that there were two kings that were at war with each other. And the king in one country declared that if anybody in his country would help him, give him advice as to how to win the war, give him some strategy, some plan for winning the war, that he would then allow this person to enter his treasure house, and for 5 minutes he can collect, he can grab anything he wants. He had 5 minutes in his treasure house. So somebody did come along with a strategy, and the king was getting ready. I mean, a promise is a promise, and all his advisors said, you can't mean it, Your Majesty. You're really going to let this person into your treasure house? You know, he can really take the most valuable things and run off, and you'll be left with whatever and depleted. The king said, listen, I gave my word. He said, but I'll tell you what, I know this person, and I know something about him. I know that this person loves beautiful music. He said, and what I'm going to do is, when this person walks in, to my treasure house, I'm going to have this most beautiful, the most beautiful of beautiful music begin to play, and he's going to get distracted. And as he moves from room to room in the treasure house, I'll keep playing more beautiful music, and we'll try to go at it. That's the what that's my plan. And this individual, sure enough, the treasure house, the big vault is opened up for him, and he's told, okay, you've got 5 minutes. He steps in, and all of it, and of course, oh, they say it too, that in knowing that he's going to be rich immediately, he outfits himself with the most beautiful clothing and his family, and he rents this most magnificent of chariots, and he comes to it like the rich man he's going to be tomorrow. And he enters the treasure vault, and all of a sudden, there's this beautiful music that begins to play. And he stops and he says, oh my gosh, this music, it's so beautiful. And then he says, oh, whoa, well, that's not what I came for. I'm supposed to be grabbing things. I'm supposed to be, you know, collecting these wonderful things that are available to me. And he starts moving towards something, and the music becomes even more beautiful. And he stops again, oh my gosh, the music. And again, that's not what I'm supposed to be doing here. I'm supposed to be collecting things. This is my only opportunity. I was sent here with a purpose. I'm here for a purpose. And meantime, and more beautiful, even more beautiful music begins to play. And all of a sudden, there's a pat there's a tap on his shoulder. Okay, buddy, time's all over. It's time's up. Out you go. And he comes out and spends the rest of his life so regretful and so remorseful over the fact that he blew it. He had the opportunity to get the most magnificent of treasures, and instead he stopped to listen to the music. And this is what our sages tell us. This is when we talk about we come here with a purpose. The Almighty is, so to speak, allowing us to come into His treasure vault. The only difference here is that the Almighty does spell out for us very clearly what our adversary will be, what he will look like. The Yetzer Hara that just waits to get us into his clutches, so to speak, this music that takes us off track, is described very clearly to us in sources, in religious sources, and we're told, watch out for this, watch out for the blandishments, watch out for that music. In your life, the music may not sound like music. It may be a more beautiful house, it may be a better job, it may be a bigger a cruise, it may be a better and bigger car, it may be more beautiful clothing, it may be whatever it is. Everybody has different music in their life, different music that distracts us and takes us off track. And every once in a while, there is this sense within us that says, oh my goodness, I was sent here to do something. There's something that I'm supposed to be doing with my life. The Almighty parted with this neshama of mine, with this soul of mine, which is the essence of my being. And if we stop to think, what about us is different than any other beings, any of the subhuman species? All of us have to come to the conclusion sooner or later that what's remarkable about us as human beings is that neshama, is that soul, that soul that doesn't, that never dies, that soul that is eternal. All those things that are material, all those things that are physical, are laid to rest after 120 years, and they're never to be heard from again. They rot in the ground. And it's only that essence that is part and parcel of the Almighty Himself, that which we call neshama, that which we call soul, that lives on forever. And that soul needs nourishment. Just as the body and our physical configuration needs a nice house and needs nice things and needs to eat and needs to drink and needs to sleep and needs to be taken care of, that essence also needs nourishment. It also needs to be nurtured. And that is an essence that's going to last for an eternity, not just for the 120 years that we find ourselves in this world. It's an eternal something that's taken as part of and parcel of God Himself. So it's very important for us, in order to be able to deal with stress appropriately, that we need to know what life is all about. The Almighty has sent us here, and this is the treasure vault. And the Almighty told us, you have an opportunity. Compared to the world, to the eternal world, the few years we spend in this world is like 5 minutes. He had 5 minutes in the treasure vault. We have whatever it is, up to 120 years, and it's like 5 minutes. And the Almighty is pleading with us, don't get distracted. You'll be hearing all kinds of music, but don't get far off field by that music. Remember what I sent you there to do. Remember to gather those treasures in that very, very short amount of time. And as it affects stress, oftentimes we look at our lives, and I'm sure that you've all had this experience at one point or another, and we say to ourselves, you know, I pretty much have most things that I would write if a person asks themselves, what do I need? And let me write it down on paper, and I give a look at the list that I make. I have most of those things, but why is it that I don't feel a real satisfaction in life? Why don't I feel that sipuk ha-nefesh? Why don't I have that? And really what that is what we call existential stress. It's a stress that says, you know what, all things may be in order, but why? What are you doing here? What are we here for? Are we accomplishing that which the Almighty has sent us here to do? What are we existing for? And that underlying everything that we are doing that's positive, there's this underlying current in our life, and then it manifests itself in a million and one ways, in dissatisfaction here and there and everywhere. And it's really the neshama calling out to us, that soul calling out to us and saying, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, nourish me, do something for me. Time's running out, your 5 minutes, our 5 minutes are almost up. That's the existential stress that we experience. So before we get to anything else, it's important for us to get that aspect together, to understand the why of our life. Because once that why, once that's in place, we can move on to the other things. And of course, one of the ways that we can get this why and this, we can manage and we can arrange things such that we can collect that treasure are some things that are very, very critical and very important. What we need to do is to keep learning. We must keep learning Jewishly. We must keep growing Jewishly. We must create classes. As many classes as we have, we must see to it that more classes are formed. We're told, the Torah says, "In tazveinu yom yomayim azveka." If you leave me for 1 day, I leave you for 2 days. There's no standing still in life. If we stop learning, if we 1 day we don't learn, we fall backwards 2 days. So it's important, what I knew yesterday is not enough for today, and what I know today is not enough for tomorrow. It's not, if you're in the field of medicine, or you're in the field of law, or in the field of business, and whatever field you find yourself in, you know that you have to keep current on everything, in the field of computers, and anything, everything's progressive, everything's constantly developing. And I can't operate by what I know from 10 years ago, from 5 years ago, not even from a month ago. I've got to keep current. And that's about the peripheral things in our life. And certainly that essential, those eternal, that internal stuff that's within us, that neshama, it's only in learning that we keep current with our neshama. So we have to keep learning. That's so vast. What the Torah has to teach us is so magnificent. And the only way that we will keep ourselves on track in the treasure house is to keep learning. So we need to keep learning. And also, by the way, anybody I would ask here, as for myself as well, and if I asked anybody, tell me what's the most important thing in your life? I think for the most part, we would say our children, right? Our children. I've heard this from everybody. Our children are the most important thing in our life. And why can't you take a class? Why can't you study? Oh, my time, you know, I have to provide for my children. After all, I have to see to it that I have enough money to send them to the best schools. I have to give them music lessons. I have to give them ballet. I have to give them camping experience. I have to give them and I have to give them, and the list is endless. And then the children grow up, and they generally, everybody we know that they practice not what we preach, but they practice what we live, right? And they give a look at mommy and daddy and how hassled they were, and they work themselves to the bone to provide all of these things for them, for the children. So the children grow up and they are now the parents, and they start going that same route, working late hours into the night. They don't see day, they don't see night. They have to hustle to provide all. And you stop them in midstream. You say to them, "Why do you have this kind of frantic schedule? Why don't you take some time out? Go do something for your own neshama. Go learn. Go do something that you know you need to do for yourself." And they say, "But I can't. My children. I got to provide for my children." And one person once said, "Give me that ultimate child." That ultimate child, as all of these generations lost their sense of spirituality, they had lost their treasures in their treasure vault. Give me, I want to strangle that ultimate child for which all of these generations lost their lives, their meaningful lives. So at some point we have to stop ourselves and say, you know, it's the best thing I can give to my child is an example. I can model for them. If my children see that, you know what, they ask me, where are you going tonight, Mom? Now, I'm not going to play bridge, I'm not going to the tennis clubs, and I'm not going to whatever it is, not even to take you to for your piano lesson. Tonight I have a class. I'm going to study some chumash. I'm going to study the portion of the week. I'm going to study some Jewish thought, hashkafa. I'm going to study machshava, whatever it is, whatever area interests you, that's what I'm doing. And that is a message that's far greater than anything else you can do for your child. Because what happens is that our children grow up with a sense that Judaism is something, we have a pediatric Judaism. Yes, you have to learn. You have to learn until such time as I get you through your school, whatever it is, whether it's day school or high school or maybe a few years of a college of sorts. But after that, you're home free. That's it. Learning, that's it. You've graduated and you never have to crack a book again. That's the end of Judaism. It's a pediatric Judaism, where in fact, as we move into adulthood, what's on the horizon is so vast, and there's so much that beckons to us, and there's so much that we need yet to learn, that we need, if we want to do something for our children, the best thing we can do to our children is walk hand in hand with them to the house of study. They go to their classes and we go to our classes. And there's no substitute for growing through learning. There's absolutely no substitute. So that will keep us, is more likely than anything else to keep us on track. Listen, another item of the faith bases the context for dealing with stress is understanding hashgacha pratis, that we understand, and this is very, very critical, that everything that happens to us, those stressful situations, difficult situations in our lives, situations we would rather not have, that all of them flow from a God who cares supremely about each and every one of us, who attends to each and every one of us. Every challenge we have in life is custom-made for each of us. We each have resources within us that need to be brought to the fore, and our lives are custom-made so that they, if we choose appropriately, then to meet those challenges, then we bring out the resources that the Almighty has given us, and we become the people that we can become. We actualize the potential that is within each and every one of us. So those things that are difficult for us, which we generally assume, and we subsume them under the category of punishment, that stresses in life, generally, Jewishly, for the most part, are not seen as punishments. They are seen as opportunities. They are seen as means for the Ribbono Shel Olam to kind of egg us on, to force us to draw on some of those koiches hanefesh that we have that we don't even know that we have until we're forced to use them. Think back to situations that were difficult in your life, and how before those situations, how you when you would think about something like that which has occurred to you, you would have thought for sure that you could not live through it. You would have thought for sure that you would have totally collapsed under its weight. And here we find ourselves so much time hence since that. And Baruch Hashem, we give a look, and some of us may even acknowledge the fact that the kind of human beings that we've become as a result of those things, even though we never would have chosen to have those experiences, those difficult experiences, but as a result of those experiences, we've become far better people, far stronger people than we ever would have become had we not had that challenge. And that's because there's hashgacha pratis. That's because all of this is not arbitrary and it's not capricious. It comes from a God who cares, a God who loves us, and a God who tailors everything individually to every single human being on this globe. And as a result of that, another thing that we need to know is that we look at other people, and this is a mistake that we make, and we all make this mistake, that we look at other people and we say, wow, they've got a charmed life. Give a look. Wonderful husband, wonderful wife. Everything they need. Terrific children. They don't need it. They're not wanting for anything. why couldn't I have a little bit of this glick, a little bit of this happiness, this good fortune that that person had? And really, based on Hashgacha Pratis, we can never make a comment like that. Because what I have is relevant for me. Given the fact that it flows from this being who loves me and who strung me together and who knows what I need in order to bring out my potential, he has given me everything that I need for my life. And what I have for my life is not relevant for your life. And what you have in your life is not relevant for my life. So there's no point in my wanting yours or you and your wanting mine. And we find so often, when you even look at the makeup of different people, and it's so erroneous again to look at somebody and you say, "Oy, Gitl, why can't Gitl cope better? After all, what does Gitl have to contend with? Gitl has a face, one child only, and she has so much help, and she has this, and she has whatever. And I know, look what I have to contend with, and I manage so well with all." I mean, and you know that we've all looked at people and we've had these thoughts. If we haven't made the comments, fortunately, if we're fortunate enough not to make the comments, at least we've had a thought, a fleeting thought, hopefully, here and there. Why can't that person manage? And the fact is that we're all so different from one another. What the Rabbeinu Shel Olam have for one person something, who has certain coping mechanisms, the Almighty has blessed them with heavy-duty coping mechanisms. For that person, for Rabbi Wasser, middle of the freeway, he didn't look like it fazed him at all. I could tell you my heart was beating a little fast. And we're different kinds of people. He takes it in stride. We're all, I remember so clearly, I mean, this thought and this understanding was struck home. I had a friend many years ago who was going through an absolutely horrific marriage. And practically every night she found herself in the middle of the night at my house, and it was just awful. And she spent, as a result of that marriage, she spent a lot of time in our house. And our house is Kinahara, a very lively place. And the people coming, going, phones ringing day and night, and doorbells, and you never know, I mean, you never know what's coming next. And she spent all the time, and then she turns around to me one day and she says, "I don't know how you can handle this. How can you live this kind of life?" And I looked at her with such amazement. You who have this miserable marriage, who I don't know where you're going to find yourself the next minute, who have all of these real, real tsaros, and you're telling me that you couldn't handle my life? Baruch Hashem, what I have is healthy. Okay, it's exciting, but it's healthy. How? And she meant it 100%. And you know what? She could not have handled my life. I could not have handled her life, and she could not have handled my life. So it's when we look objectively speaking, things don't matter objectively. It's just it's really totally subjective, because it depends on the way we're strung together, and the Almighty, knowing how we're strung together, because He strung us together, knows the challenges that He addresses each and every one of us, and that those are relevant only to ourselves, and we have the tools and the resources, again, if we choose to use them, to handle the stresses of our own life. Now, part of what helps us handle that is attitude in life, and I don't think that comes as a big surprise to you. Now, a lot of work has been done in the alternative to medicine movement, I don't know if you call it movement or field, of the mind and body connection. How it's mind over matter, mind over so much. And they've done tons and tons and tons of studies, and if I had time, I would read you some of these studies, where it's there's no question that a positive attitude is three-quarters of the battle. It has to do with illnesses, Rahman Litzlan, God forbid. If a person has a positive attitude, how much longer people live with positive attitudes. It has to do with the quality of life that a person has, that an attitude makes such a difference. It has to do with relationships, an attitude makes such a difference. So some people have the attitude in life is, and all of us are familiar with people, who life is out to get me. You know, it's a conspiracy. My children, my husband, my job, my boss, everybody, it's all there, they're out to get me. And I'm the victim. And it's a matter of whether we look at every situation that comes up in life, do we see it as a wall or do we see it as a door? For some people see everything that comes up in life as a tremendous barrier,
as a tremendous wall, and other people see it as an opportunity, as a door of opportunity. It's a way through which I can grow. I had a Zayde who's called the Zlotshava Magid, and the Zlotshava Magid said that he had a tradition straight from Moses all the way down the line, and the tradition was that things that you can't do anything about, there are only two things in life: things that you can do something about, things that you can't do anything about. Things that you cannot do anything about, the tradition is, don't worry about them, because you can't do anything about them. Things that you can do something about, don't worry about them, just do something about them. And of course the Serenity Prayer goes on yet and says, and please God, give us the wisdom to know the difference. And this is really a very wonderful prayer. And it's a matter of attitude. And one of the ways that we really can help ourselves with the attitude is to ask ourselves the question, will what I am experiencing now, or this that's has the possibility of creating stress in my life, is going to really matter to me in 5 years from now? What's going to matter to me in 5 years from now? In 5 years from now, I don't want to waste my time on things that won't matter in 5 years from now, and I certainly don't want to worry about things that aren't going to matter in 5 years from now. So I think it's important for us, in terms of setting our priorities and deciding what's important in life, to ask ourselves that question. And the other side of that question is also, if we want to determine that, is to ask ourselves what mattered so much in our life. And this is a very important question, and some of you may have already addressed that question. If I hope that all of you have parents who are living, but those of us who have experienced, nobody should know from the death of a parent, we know the kind of things that our parents did for us that really mattered. And they're not, and most often they're not the kind of things that we're busy chasing all day long. What are the kind of things that mattered? A good word when we were down and out. You know, a pat on the back, an act of kindness. Who are the people that mattered in our life? It wasn't parents. What really made a difference in my life? What shaped and formed me? And who was it that did it, and how did they do it? And once we've looked at that, and we take a moment to introspect and to think about that, then those are the things that we should pursue in our life, to do those kind of things, and to create for those who follow us the memories that those before us have created for us. Okay, let's move on. I know it's getting late. Some of the things that help us in dealing with stress. All of us need a support system. We need people, and Tehillim, Psalms, it says, the Oga Belev Ish Yasichena. If a person has a worry, it helps them to speak about it, to talk about it, to have somebody to speak to about things. It's important to have support groups. It's important to have support groups. It helps us maintain our perspective. Our support group should be made up of people who have the same values that we have, so we can remain on track in that treasure vault. We need, when we have people to share our lives with, it multiplies our joys, it divides our sorrow. We need to be able to laugh with people. We need to be able to laugh. You all know, I'm sure, the book that Norman Cousins wrote. I forget, what was it called? I forget what it's called, but Norman Cousins had a terrible illness, and he laughed himself out of his illness. And all of the newest research and studies, again, speak about how important laughter is for the psyche, how laughter does such wonders for us. He said, Norman Cousins found that of every 10 minutes of belly laugh, he was able to get 2 hours of pain-free, uninterrupted sleep. This was a man who was virtually racked with pain all day long. So it's important to learn how to laugh. He tells a very cute story, and how he said he remembers the look on the face of the nurse who was treating him once, when she came in, he was in the hospital, he was so deathly ill, and she gave him a container for a urine specimen. And when she left the room, he filled the container with apple juice. And she came back, and she said, oh, Mr. Cousins, it's very blurry today. So he says to her, this is worth, let's see, how does he put it here? It was so good. Oh, and he looks at her and he says, you know, you're absolutely right. I'd better put it through again. And he drank it. And he said that the look on her face follows him around to this day. And he points to the fact that laughter does, and he has it all, you know, everything that it does with the adrenaline, and it stimulates the pituitary glands and the production of endorphins and all the good things, everything that the body needs in order to be able to deal with the stresses of life. So laughing and creating situations for lighter moments is very, very important. Hugging, smiling, and I have articles to that effect about how important it is, a hug. You all know those studies that were done with babies in the neonatal departments that fared well, those that were hugged and held closely. But it doesn't stop there, it doesn't stop in the neonatal. All of us need a little bit of that that body language, that affirmative, positive body language. A smile, how a smile can make a difference in a person's life. And the focus on others, they did wonderful studies in old homes. They found that people who related to others, who had the supportive context, who went beyond themselves and focused not only on themselves, as we're prone to do as we get older, we get so self-absorbed, and we were hurting a little more, the bones are creaking a little more, and we're worried about ourselves, and legitimately so, but when the focus is totally on ourselves, it produces the kind of stress that doesn't make for longevity or for quality of life. They did studies in the old homes where they found that among even the aged, those people who reached out to others are the ones who lived longer and who had a much better quality of life. Now, what we need to do is also, and this comes as stop to smell the flowers. And also, what's very, very important in our stressful existence is to learn, for us to learn relaxation techniques. To learn from wherever, whether it's the self-hypnosis or meditation type, or there's Jewish meditation types of relaxation modes, just to be able to take, and sometimes takes 10 to 15 minutes, and you stop in the middle of your busy day, it's amazing how that produces so much more positive energy that we can then use appropriately. What's also very important for us to understand is that we need to solicit advice. We need to solicit advice, and we need to engage that third party in our life. Whether it's if we're having difficulties, the stress comes as a result of economic pressures, we need to engage somebody who's in the field of economics. If we're having difficulties with our marriage, with our interpersonal relationship, it's very important to avail ourselves of a therapist. And here, I want to make another important plea. When there are problems, most times, unfortunately, we tend to sweep those problems under the rug initially. Oh, they don't exist. It's not, you know, well, I'll get over it. I'll buy the bigger house. I'll go on my cruise. I'll take a vacation. It's this and that. And we don't address the problems. People come to us, and literally, after they leave, we cry. Because had these people come 10 years earlier, 15 years earlier, at the onset of these problems, there would have been so much we could have done for them. And they just let these things fester and multiply, and there's so much water under the bridge, there's so much harm and bad feelings that have been generated, there's so much resentment, there's so much anger, there's so much hatred, that at this point, it's too little, too late, unfortunately. So it's so important, whatever it is, when in doubt, seek help. Whether it's with a child, whether it's a husband, whether it's a wife, seek, and of course, I have to qualify this by saying that you need to get competent help. Not just any, it has to be a competent person. Check your references, find out who knows the person, but seek competent help. And if you do that in time, generally speaking, most situations can be helped, alleviated, set right, whatever. In matters of halacha and Jewish life, we're told, "Asei lecha rav v'histalek min hasafek." Don't walk around with doubts. I don't know. Should I be doing so much? Should I be doing little? Should I be doing more? You have a wonderful rav in this community, and I'm sure that wherever you may come from, that there are very wonderful, competent rabbanim who are just waiting for your call. And I say they're waiting for your call. We have situations that we only wish people would ask. For instance, in matters of heroic measures, when it comes to loved ones in the hospital. And it's a question, should they be put on a respirator? Should they be taken off a respirator? Should we put a tube in? Should we give them antibiotics? Should we? And the myriad of questions and conflicts. And when the loved ones determine that this is a halachic question, in addition, of course, the halachic authority will consult with the medical community, for sure. But then once they give a rendering, once they make a decision based on a halacha that's been with us for almost 4,000 years, it's such a relief. It so relieves the stress of loved ones to know that this was taken out of their hands, that they did that which the Almighty would want them to do. Because otherwise, invariably, no matter what you do, you're not in a good place. If you put a parent on a respirator and you watch them suffer, then you say, oh, who needed this? Why did I subject my loved one to this? If you take them off of a respirator, then you say, who knows, they could have been part of that minority who all of a sudden come to life. We've all heard of those miraculous events. And we're between a rock and a hard place. In any case, the way we can alleviate that stress is to subject the question to a halakhic authority. And this is in this matter, it's in matters, everything that's part of Jewish life. If you consult a halakhic authority, your rabbi, you can alleviate many of these stresses. And I don't have to tell you that when, Chalila, there's an illness, to avail yourself of a health professional. The last item on the list is tefillah. That above and beyond, the beginning, the middle, and the end, is to ask, to seek the help of the Almighty. To ask the Almighty to hold our hand as we move through life. And turning to tefillah is prayer. When we look to the Almighty and we pray to God, and you can pray in many different ways. We have our structured prayer, which is very definitely a way to go. In addition to that, we have our own, just to say, our own tefillahs. Wherever we are, wherever we find ourselves, however we want to say it, God understands our language, whatever language we speak. And to say to the Almighty in any which way that we know how. At that point, we just drop the whole facade and we say, God Almighty, you're my daddy in heaven. You love me very much. I really need this. I really think I need it. I really want this. If I can't have it, help me understand why not. And if I can have it, then please, God, give it to me. So it's important to keep the Almighty at our side. And also, in doing that, in confirming and affirming the fact that everything that happens to us flows from the Almighty, we do something magnificent for ourselves because we take that stress off of our own shoulders. If we go through life thinking that I'm the source of everything that happens to me, it's a tremendous load to carry. If I give the world back to God, God, you know, I guess you run the world. So, okay, I'm going to acknowledge the fact that you run the world. And what that does for me is, you know how discombobled and how injured and how destroyed we get by failures in life. Why are we destroyed by our failures? We're destroyed by our failures because we perceive that we're responsible for our failures. And we come along here and in tefillah, when we acknowledge the Almighty as the source of everything in our life, what we really basically are saying is, you know what, God, I know what you want from me. You want me to put forth my very best effort. And that's what I am going to do in life. Put forth my very best effort. But above and beyond putting forth my very best effort, the rest is in your hands. Whether you're going to crown that effort with success is up to you entirely. So when I make a move and I make a big business deal and I do my best and it falls through, I don't look at myself and I say, boy, am I a shlemazel and a shlemiel. I say, I tried my best. I did what I was supposed to do. God, you didn't think that it was supposed to happen. You didn't think it was in my best interest. So I'll try again next time. And the whole responsibility doesn't fall on my shoulders and I can remain with my self-esteem intact. It doesn't destroy me. And on the other hand, it also gives me a sense of humility at times when I have these tremendous victorious and triumphant moments in my life. The business deal does go through and I'm now sitting on top of the world. So do I become this big shot now? Do I again trace all of this back to my own doing? Now the same dynamic has to be engaged and enforced here. Almighty, I did what you wanted me to do. I put forth my very best effort. You chose to crown it with success. thank you very much. I know it comes from you. I know it flows from you. So when we acknowledge the Almighty as the supreme mover in our lives, then all of these stresses, these tremendous stresses in life, fall into place, and they're manageable, and they're tolerable, and they're constructive, and they're productive. So it's very important to engage in tefillah. And I'd like to close, and you're welcome to ask questions or make comments if you feel that you still want to stay longer. But then my husband, every time he goes to a drugstore someplace, picks up these cute little cards for me that he knows I enjoy, and then I can share them with you and others. This is called The Difference. I got up early one morning and rushed right into the day. I had so much to accomplish that I didn't have time to pray. Problems just tumbled about me, and heavier came each task. Why doesn't God help me, I wondered. He answered, you didn't ask. I wanted to see joy and beauty, but the day toiled gray and bleak. I wondered why God didn't show me. He said, but you didn't seek. I tried to come into God's presence. I used all my keys at the lock. God gently and lovingly chided, my child, you didn't knock. I woke early this morning and paused before entering the day. I had so much to accomplish that I had to take time to pray. Thank you very much.